It is nearly 12 o'clock and time for the KMXT Midday Report. Thank you for listening to KMXT, broadcasting on 100.1 FM. It is your public radio station here in beautiful downtown Kodiak, Alaska, where it is 38 degrees under partly cloudy skies. At the airport, they are showing 55% humidity, north winds steady at 16, gusting to 26, and they have 10 miles of visibility. The Weather Service is calling for partly sunny skies today, mostly clear skies tonight, and sunny skies tomorrow. Northeast winds to 20, gusting to 30 today, coming down to 15, gusting to 25 tonight, and finally 10, gusting to 20 tomorrow. Coming up on the Midday Report, the U.S. Supreme Court case about herring that's actually about a lot more than herring. The electrical cooperative that powers lots and lots of small communities in Alaska is proposing a rate increase of almost 15%. And North Slope oil production is projected to rise significantly. Those stories and more after national headlines.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. Critical failures. That's the Justice Department's analysis of how law enforcement agencies responded to the mass shooting at Robb Elementary School in Uvalde, Texas, where gunmen killed 19 children and two teachers. Federal officials released their findings today, more than a year and a half after the attack. NPR's Ryan Lucas says the report confirms more than an hour passed from the moment officers arrived on the scene to when they confronted and killed the gunman.
The students and the teachers trapped in the classrooms with the gunman were waiting to be rescued. They could hear the police in the hallways, and they waited. One student at a certain point called 911 from the classroom and told the authorities that there were victims inside, and they still had to wait.
NPR's Ryan Lucas reporting. In New Hampshire, former South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley is trying to make it a two-person race between herself and the current frontrunner for the GOP nomination, former President Donald Trump. NPR's Tamara Keith reports with the primary less than a week away, Haley is campaigning with the state's popular Republican governor, who endorsed her.
New Hampshire Governor Chris Sununu is touting Haley as the best chance to knock out former President Trump as the leader of the Republican Party. Sununu blames Trump for election losses for Republicans up and down the ballot going back to 2018.
I want to win. Donald Trump is a loser. He kept losing seats for the Republican Party. I'm tired of losers. Let's get the Republican back on track, bring winners to the table, and turn the country around.
Loser is an insult often hurled by the former president, who is currently ahead of Haley in both national polls and in New Hampshire. Sununu says his candidate has a lock on second, and, quote, all signs point to a potential upset in New Hampshire. Tamara Keith, NPR News, Hooksett, New Hampshire.
U.S. stocks traded higher on new housing data and jobs numbers that beat Wall Street's expectations. NPR's David Gura reports Wall Street is scaling back its expectations for when the Federal Reserve will start cutting interest rates.
There were just over 180,000 first-time applications for unemployment last week. That's a smaller number than economists anticipated. Federal Reserve policymakers, including Atlanta Fed President Raphael Bostic, continue to suggest interest rate cuts are not imminent. The yield on the 10-year Treasury remains above 4%. The average rate on the 30-year fixed-rate mortgage fell to 6.6%, according to Freddie Mac. That's the lowest it's been in 8 months. Technology shares traded higher, led by TSMC, the world's largest microchip manufacturer. Its stock rose by about 8% after the company reported strong earnings. David Gura, NPR News, New York.
The Dow's closed up more than 200 points. It's NPR News.
NPR News is brought to you in part by Providence Kodiak Island Counseling Center. For an appointment or more information, 481-2400.
For KMXT, I'm Terry Haynes. The U.S. Supreme Court heard a case brought by small boat fishermen on the East Coast yesterday. They object to a federal requirement that they pay to have observers on board. As Alaska Public Media Washington correspondent Liz Ruskin reports, the case could loosen federal regulation across the board.
We'll hear argument first this morning in case 22-12-19, Relentless versus the Department of Commerce.
For a case brought by Atlantic herring fishermen rooted in the Magnuson-Stevens Act, the nation's foremost fishing law, fish were barely mentioned. Lawyers and the justices referred much more to an oil company.
Chevron deference.
Chevron deference.
And Chevron.
Chevron.
Which is Chevron.
Chevron deference was a standard the court established in a 1984 case, and overturning it is the true aim of the herring case. Chevron deference stands for the principle that if it's not clear what Congress meant when it passed a particular law, judges should give deference to the government agency's view, as long as that view is reasonable. Chevron is the backbone of federal regulation, whether it's an agency enforcing an environmental restriction, an aviation rule, or policing any of the other industries the feds regulate. Attorney Roman Martinez, representing the Atlantic herring fishermen, says Chevron deference means legal challenges are always tilted to favor the government. He says it takes away the authority of a judge to decide who has the better interpretation of a law.
I think deference becomes problematic when it requires a judge to say that the law means X, when really the judge thinks the law means Y.
Martinez argued in harmony with Justice Neil Gorsuch. Gorsuch says it's a question of who decides. Should a judge decide based on the strength of each side's argument, Gorsuch asks?
Or does the judge abdicate that responsibility and say automatically whatever the agency says wins?
Right, even if the judge is not persuaded.
But Justice Elena Kagan says that's not how Chevron deference works. She says a judge uses all tools available to glean congressional intent, the letter of the law, the context, the legislative history. And if there's still ambiguity, Kagan says it only makes sense to defer to the agency, because they're subject matter experts. They know the facts on the ground. And, unlike judges, agencies are at least accountable to an elected president. Kagan asked what happens when disputes arise over highly technical matters like artificial intelligence.
Will courts be able to decide these issues as to things they know nothing about? Courts that are completely disconnected from the policy process, from the political process, that just don't have any expertise and experience in an area, or are people and agencies going to do that? That's what this case is about.
The term fishing or fisherman was uttered only a handful of times over 2 hours, and at-sea observers, hardly at all. Sitka-based fisherman Linda Bankin is director of the Alaska Longline Fishermen's Association, representing small boat commercial harvesters of halibut and other federally regulated species. She says fishermen she knows have their own gripes about the observer program. But Bankin's emphasis is on sustainable fisheries, and she does not feel aligned with the Atlantic herring fishermen who brought the case to dump the Chevron doctrine.
Sounds like there's a pretty deliberate attempt to dismantle federal agencies and their authority to manage resources, and yes, that causes me some concern.
A roster of conservatives and anti-regulation advocates wrote friend of the court briefs arguing to end Chevron deference. They include the Goldwater Institute, Gun Owners of America, the vaping industry, and 18 states, including Alaska, through State Attorney General Treg Taylor. Those who weighed in to support regulation include the American Cancer Society, the Environmental Defense Fund, and a quartet of Democratic senators. A decision is expected by early July. Reporting from the Supreme Court, I'm Liz Ruskin.
The electrical cooperative that powers communities across western Alaska, southeast, and southwest Alaska, including communities on Kodiak Island, is proposing an average rate increase of almost 15%. Bill Stamm is the president and CEO of the Alaska Village Electric Cooperative, or AVEC. Put simply, he says the cooperative is proposing a rate increase because, quote, everything is more expensive.
I think everybody that lives in rural Alaska has felt the increase in costs of just about everything.
Stamm says the proposed AVEC rate increase is what the cooperative needs to stay in business. He says the financial contrast between 2021 and 2022 was stark. In 2021, the electrical provider had an operating budget with a $1.7 million surplus. The next year, it was almost $5 million in the hole. Higher prices don't just impact day-to-day operations. As a cooperative, Stamm says the budget surplus gets reinvested into capital improvement projects in member communities. He says increased costs and longer lead times on materials have significantly delayed infrastructure projects for the electrical cooperative, which serves 59 communities, most of them in western Alaska. Stamm says the cooperative did a cost of service study last year.
We found that not only were we under-collecting revenue in general, there were some communities that were under-collecting more than others.
The Alaska Village Electric Cooperative has different rates for small and large customers in different communities, as well as for residential and commercial customers. Proposed rate increases vary depending on the type of service, but basically work out to a 14.9% increase on average. Stamm says this is on top of the prior year's increase of around 9%. How exactly a rate increase impacts customers will depend on fuel costs, which vary widely between communities throughout the cooperative's service areas and are charged separately from costs other than fuel.
We burn over 9 million gallons of diesel fuel a year throughout Alaska. All of that diesel fuel has to be transported and stored in the communities and then brought to our power plants and used. And the cost of doing that in each community varies greatly depending on how far away they are from the source and how difficult it is to get fuel there. Some of it's delivered by barge. Some of it has to be flown in. We burn over 9 million gallons of diesel fuel a year throughout Alaska. All of that diesel fuel has to be transported and stored in the communities and then brought to our power plants and used. And the cost of doing that in each community varies greatly depending on how far away they are from the source and how difficult it is to get fuel there. Some of it's delivered by barge. Some of it has to be flown in.
An increase to AVEC rates won't necessarily directly translate to the same increase on a customer's electricity bill. That's in large part due to the state's power cost equalization program, which subsidizes energy costs in rural communities. Stamm told KYUK in 2021 that if power cost equalization were not in place, electrical costs in some rural areas could more than double. AVEC will hold a public hearing on the proposed rate increases January 29th in their Anchorage boardroom. North Slope oil production is projected to rise significantly in the coming decade. That's according to a state production forecast presented to lawmakers on Wednesday. Alaska Public Media reports that oil production has been flat or declining over the past 5 years. In the short term, it's expected to stay fairly stable at roughly 480,000 barrels per day through mid-2025. But the Commissioner of Alaska's Department of Natural Resources, John Boyle, says he expects a more than 30% increase by 2032.
We are realizing currently a major boom in investment, and I think it's safe to say that we really are starting a new chapter when it comes to the future of the North Slope and the types of operators that we're seeing up there.
Boyle says he expects major projects like ConocoPhillips Willow and Santos Pikka to drive much of the growth. Pikka is expected to start production in 2026, with Willow following in 2029. Boyle says he's also encouraged to see a returning oil producer, Apache, partnering with Armstrong to drill 3 wells on the eastern portion of the North Slope. By the end of the decade, Boyle expects existing fields like Prudhoe Bay to make up a minority of the oil flowing through the Trans-Alaska Pipeline System. Senator Bert Stedman, a Sitka Republican and co-chair of the Senate Finance Committee, welcomed the forecast.
Things look a lot brighter, especially with all the national headwinds on oil and gas. We've done well, relatively speaking, what we have to deal with. So we do have a bright future in our oil basin.
The state also offers high-end and low-end forecasts, which diverge significantly. The high-end forecast shows production climbing to nearly a million barrels per day by 2033, and the low-end forecast would have production falling by roughly 20% over that same period. For the past year, production came in roughly 3% lower than the state's forecast. Scientists at the University of Alaska Fairbanks have mapped out where a prehistoric mammoth spent her life in what's now Canada and Alaska, and found evidence of human hunting camps in many of the same places. As KUAC's Robin reports, the research published this week in the journal Science Advances uses chemicals found in the mammoth's tusks to track where the prehistoric animal lived.
Mammoths and humans spent about 1,000 years together in Beringia, the far northern swath of land revealed during the last ice age. A new study from UAF shows how mammoths traveled across the northern side of the continental ice sheet and shed some light on how humans hunted them. Audrey Rowe is getting her PhD at UAF and is the lead author on the paper published this week in Science Advances.
I do chemical analyses to try to reconstruct the movement of large mammals in Alaska.
She studied a 14,000-year-old tusk from a female mammoth that was found at the Swan Point archaeological site near Quartz Lake in interior Alaska.
The interesting thing about tusks, they grow throughout the lifetime of the mammoth, sort of like ice cream cones being stacked on top of each other every single day.
Every day of a mammoth's life, there's a new layer of minerals being laid down in the tusk. Rowe's colleague and one of the co-authors of the study, Professor Matt Wooler, says looking at those cones, you can tell where the mammoth has been.
And luckily for us, mammoths carry this kind of chemical GPS unit on their face, which is their tusks.
And that tusk has a little bit of strontium in it from the location that the mammoth is in that's being laid down in that sort of daily growth layer.
And so that tusk is gradually getting forced out of the head of a mammoth and is recording the entire lifespan of that mammoth's movement, its diet, its behavior, its age.
Rowe and Wooler split the tusk right down the middle and took samples from the center to measure the chemical isotopes. Then they compared the strontium in the tusk layers to what's known about the element around Alaska.
Yeah, it's chemistry. It is largely thanks to the U.S. Geological Survey, has a pretty good grasp on what minerals are where in the bedrock in Alaska and how old these rocks are.
We analyzed a whole bunch of isotope chemistry along the length of that tusk, and then we compared changes in that chemistry to maps that we have of the chemistry of Alaska.
They were able to back calculate where the mammoth had lived and traveled.
And it turns out that interior Alaska site that she used the most, it overlaps stunningly with all of the archaeological sites from around that time period.
They found that she was born and grew up east of the Yukon, but wandered west before she died, about 45 miles south of where Fairbanks is now. Oh, and they named the mammoth they were studying.
Her full name is Alma Ije. We abbreviate that to Alma, and it was a name that was given by the Healy Village Council. We worked with them to come up with a name, and so they came up with Alma Ijei, which translates to something like Hella looking. Not beautiful, but very striking in appearance.
Alma was about 20 years old and healthy when she died 14,000 years ago, likely harvested by human hunters. In Fairbanks, I'm Robin.
The Volunteer Fire Department that covers much of the greater Delta Junction area has temporarily shut down operations following a financial breach that's left it unable to pay for insurance. KUAC's Tim Ellis reports.
The Rural Deltana Volunteer Fire Department Board has informed Alaska State Troopers about what they're calling accounting discrepancies that have left the department without enough money to pay its insurance bill. But a trooper spokesperson declined to comment on the matter. Rural Deltana Board Chair Dave Neuberger says the board members contacted troopers soon after they discovered the problem, which some sources say led to a six-figure budget shortfall.
Once we discovered this serious breach of trust, we took immediate action to address the situation.
The Rural Daltana Board said in a statement released last week that, quote, neglect or incompetence led to the failure to pay for the insurance. And it says the board replaced Fire Chief Mike Pascal and removed him from his position as board secretary.
We are fully cooperating with law enforcement and other authorities to ensure a fair and just resolution to this matter.
Pascal declined to be interviewed, and sources Following say he's left the state. Neuberger wouldn't provide additional information about what happened, but he says the board is focused on making changes to prevent the problem from reoccurring.
As we move forward, the department leadership and accountability processes are being reevaluated.
Delta Junction Fire Chief Tony White informed the city council about Rural Daltana's situation during a Tuesday meeting.
As of Thursday morning, Rural Daltana Fire Department had to close their doors and they are unable to provide services.
City Administrator Ken Greenleaf told the council that he and Mayor J.W. Musgrove have worked out an arrangement with the Rural Daltana Board, authorizing the Delta firefighters to respond to calls outside of city limits where three-quarters of the area's population lives.
The City Delta has temporarily expanded its primary service area to include the service area normally covered by the Rural Daltana Fire Department while that department undergoes some reorganization and operational changes.
The Fort Greely Fire Department also will respond as needed under the terms of a mutual aid agreement. Greenleaf said Delta has agreed to allow Rural Daltana's volunteers to join the city fire department, and he says a dozen have already signed up.
Volunteers from that department have largely moved over to the city for the time being. It's a temporary move.
Greenleaf said in an interview later that the arrangement won't cost the city much to add the new firefighters to the roster.
There's no pay involved other than, you know, just, you know, the workman's comp while they're actually responding on something.
Both he and Musgrove both said they're hopeful the situation will be resolved soon. Meanwhile, a dozen Rural Daltana volunteers are undergoing training with the city's fire engines and equipment because their trucks and gear are locked up until the insurance bill is paid. In Delta, I'm Tim Ellis.
Following an emotional six-day trial, a Ketchikan Superior Court closed the book on a 30-year-old cold case that has haunted the city. Michael J. Williams of Saxman was found guilty of first-degree sexual assault and second-degree sexual abuse of a minor. He faces a sentence of up to 30 years in prison. KRBD's Jack Darrell reports on a trial that for both parties all came down to the DNA.
In January of 1993, a 14-year-old girl was walking across Dudley Field near Ketchikan's high school. It was dark and raining, turning the snow on the ground to slush. As she crossed the field, a man in green fishing-style rain gear and a black scarf wrapped around his face grabbed her from behind and pulled her into the dugout. He told her that he had a knife and would use it on her if she called for help. He raped the girl and then fled. Samples were collected from the 14-year-old survivor at the time, but the case went unsolved for decades. Prosecutor Aaron McCarthy, who is also the Assistant Attorney General for the state's cold case unit, said charges against the defendant come after years of advances in DNA forensics.
Michael Williams disappeared into the dark that night, and efforts to find the assailant went cold for 30 years.
Jerry Seifert was an officer in the Ketchikan Police Department in the 90s. He was assigned to the case. He testified that in the 30 years this crime went unsolved, he hadn't been able to forget it.
It's one of those cases that have followed me over the decades that had been unsolved, that had come to mind probably 2 to 3 times a year even.
Dr. Ernie Maloche, the emergency room physician who performed the sexual assault exam on the victim, also took the stand. Ketchikan is a small community, and Maloche said he's interacted with the victim multiple times since the night in question.
In my heart, I've been thinking about her and caring for her for 30-plus years. May have given her some advice if we talk, but I'm really getting old.
Maloche stressed that his memory had degraded, but when asked if he remembered the victim coming into the emergency room that night, he paused and replied, exquisitely. DNA evidence was a linchpin in the state's case against Williams. The kit taken from the victim was tested as part of the state's push to clear its sexual assault kit backlog. After multiple decades without a hit, Michael J. Williams was a match. Cheryl Duda, who manages DNA analysis in the state's crime lab, testified that the match between the DNA in the rape kit and Williams' profile was unique.
And in each case, the estimated frequency of the genetic profile was rarer than 1 in 330 billion. In other words, it's a very rare profile.
But does DNA degrade over 30 years? Duda says it can when exposed to moisture, sunlight, or bacteria, but she testified that the crime lab manages that.
All of those are things that can break the DNA into smaller pieces. We refer to that as degrading the DNA. However, that said, if you store a biological sample in a cool, dry, dark place, it may be possible to get DNA results from items that are decades old.
Still, defense attorney Leif Thompson cast doubt on the DNA evidence throughout the trial. He noted that the case had no eyewitnesses or smoking gun.
It's a case entirely based on the science, and nobody believes in anything other than the DNA report. If anybody thinks Mr. Williams did it, it's for no other reason.
After nearly a week of testimonies, the prosecution rested. The trial returned to session the following Tuesday, and by the end of the day, Williams was found guilty. Williams was handcuffed and led from the courtroom to the Ketchikan Correctional Facility, where he'll be held without bail pending sentencing, which is scheduled for April 29th. In Ketchikan, I'm Jack Darrell.
Bank profits drop amid competition for depositors. I'm Novosafo with a Marketplace Minute. Higher interest rates have banks paying more for deposit accounts to keep customers from fleeing. That was a big reason Discover Financial today reported a 62% plunge in quarterly earnings. Profit at Ohio-based bank KeyCorp declined more than 90%. Costs were higher than expected in the last 3 months of the year for health insurer Humana. Demand for medical procedures among older patients. UnitedHealth last week reported a similar trend. Humana said it will raise Medicare Advantage premiums next year. Initial claims for unemployment benefits hit a 16-month low last week, down to 187,000. Continuing claims declined to just over 1.8 million. I'm Novosafo with the Marketplace Minute.
This is the Island Messenger, a look at personal messages, the weather, and community announcements.
Good afternoon and welcome to your Island Messenger for Thursday. It is the 18th day of January, the year 2024. Sun rose today at 9:37. It will set again at 5:02. That will give us 7 hours and 25 minutes of glorious daylight, a gain of 3 minutes and 31 seconds compared to yesterday. Our record high temperature for this date was 46 degrees set in 2014, and before that in 1930, and our record low was 3 degrees set in 1934. Currently 38 degrees under partly cloudy skies, north winds at 16, gusting to 26 at the airport right now, and they have 10 miles of visibility. The Weather Service is calling for mostly sunny skies for the rest of the day, partly cloudy overnight, and sunny skies for tomorrow. High near 38 for today and tomorrow. Northeast winds to 20, gusting to 30 today. Coming down to 20, gusting to 30 tonight. I guess that's not coming down. Turning to the northwest tomorrow to 10, gusting to 20. We have an outgoing tide. Our next low tide here on the east side will be at 1:52 this afternoon and be 1.4 feet, followed by a high tide at 7:52 of 5.7 feet. Over on the west side, your low tide will happen at 2:25 this afternoon and be 2.2 feet in Larsen Bay, followed by a high tide at 8:18 p.m. of 9.9 feet.
Listen for the Island Messenger here on Public Radio KMXT 3 times a day, Monday through Friday at 9 a.m., during the Midday Report at 12:20, and in the evening at 7 o'clock. If you have a community announcement or personal message, including lost and found items or pets, you can call KMXT at 486-3181, fax us at 486-2733, or email psa@kmxt.org.